We're back on track. This is not Tuesday. We're doing the burning bush today. Apologies. There were some people I know who said, I'm not that interested in the story of Jericho and Joshua. I was coming for the burning bush story. So my apologies if you had to endure Jericho and only now. But actually, it was a technique to try and make sure you got to as many as possible. Yes, if you, again, as usual, raise your hand if there's an empty seat close by, as people can. That's great. Yes, so my name is Glenn, and I'm from Northern Ireland, where I worked for almost 30 years now in peace and reconciliation work in Northern Ireland, and which has been there's never been a shortage of work. And I've been fascinated by, over the last number of years in particular, how some of the similarities between our own setting back home and your setting here, particularly also in recent years with our Brexit issues and the kind of things that have been feeding into Brexit, and some of the issues you're working with here. So it's always, this is my third time at home, and it's always fascinating to come and to talk, and, you know, whether in sessions like this or, you know, around the village, just to hear stories. And sometimes the stories I hear, just personal stories of people, are, you know, there's some of the most fascinating people in the world wandering around the paths here. And I'm really interested in stories, and at Corabila, where I work, we use stories and storytelling really to help people engage in difficult conversations, but also to help process some of the information. We live by stories. We all live by stories. We all make meaning through of our lives through stories. And what I've been doing is, also, if you haven't been here before, I've been indulging myself by showing you some photographs of my life back home, and so that you know a little bit more about me. This is my family. And my daughter's Philippa, her graduation last summer. And my wife, Adrienne, and my son, Christopher. Philippa is 24 next month. Christopher is 21. It's a lovely thing. It's only my third year here at Holden. I've never seen so many wee kids running around the street. Isn't that fantastic? It really is. It's lovely. And even up and down those hills, and they go tearing up and down the hills, some toiling. But there, you know, and there's part of me which misses those times when our two were young. But there's also something really, really special having an adult relationship with your children. And I do enjoy that. They get a little, they keep us in train. This is another photograph of Adrienne, my wife. This is our youngest niece. This is a photograph taken in our church, actually. Has anybody ever heard of the project called Help Portrait? It's so fabulous. It began, when you're back in civilization, Google it. It began in New York City, a professional photographer noticing homelessness on the streets of the city. Pulled together some colleagues and friends, fellow photographers, makeup artists, people with hair, they set up studios, and they invited people who were living on the street to come in and get a portrait taken. They got made up, they got their hair done, they got a portrait taken, and then they were handed a professional portrait, which they could send to loved ones if they wanted. Essentially to say, I'm still alive, or that they could carry and keep as a sign of, you know, just re-dignifying people who are living on the street. And it spread. It's all over the world now. And we ran one of them in our church with a photographer friend of mine, And that we did it to bring families back together, particularly if all we required for a free portrait was that there had to be at least three generations in each photograph. So it brought people back, you know, who weren't no longer living in the town, but perhaps their elderly parents were living in a nursing home in the town, and they brought grandkids and brought granny or grandpa out of the home and to our church, and they got their portrait taken. And my wife's mom was there, and we ended up with 1, 2, 3, 4 generations in her photograph. That's my big son, and he is very tall, but Adrian is also quite short, which he hates. But my son was for a time quite a promising rugby player, and this is him when he was, I think he was about 17, and playing for Ulster. And actually, this is my two again, just a year or so ago, and Philippa and Christopher. And this is Philippa and me on a trip to an event in Vienna in Austria, and she was so excited to be getting one of these sweet crepes with loads of cream and sugar and all sorts of chocolate. And she's just a little bit excited. And here are my real children. These are my pride and joy. This is Tess, who's a Hungarian Vizsla, a Vizsla, I think you call them over here. And this is our Bodhi, who is a wire-haired Vizsla. And this is us in the mountains.
Do they swim?
They do swim, yes. She is the most elegant dog. You know, everything about her, she's like a princess. And everything about her is dignified, you know. And she'll jump up, they own the settees, she'll jump up on the settee and she'll move the cushions out of the way and don't like that one, get rid of it, and then put this one up, and then she will lie down. But she is the most undignified swimmer in the world. And he loves it. He'll just go. But they are great, and I'm wearing my Holden t-shirt. I put that there because in the mountains of Mourne, and which is the So it's interesting. I look at those photographs, and they're all deliberately chosen to show you the best of our family. And I, you know, we do. We've made it to this age with our children, and I value that enormously. And we're very close. You know, there's lots has happened over the course of our lives. Adrian and I we had our 30th wedding anniversary last Wednesday. I was here, she was back at home, and the one thing in all the ups and downs of life, the one thing I've never doubted has been our relationship. And I feel very blessed. You know, and we still have, you know, good relationship with our children. It's a close family. And yet there's a way of telling the story of our life, of our lives together. I can look at it from one angle, and it's a story of continued and persistent disappointment and failure. Of things that didn't work. Things I got wrong, things I failed at. I have a narrative in my head that is about regular, persistent, and consistent failure. And yet other times I can step to the side of it and I can see a narrative that is joyous and happy and, you know, with sufficient success to keep me content. And it really, I guess at different times in life, I can, depending on what's going on, I can stand in either set of shoes. I don't know if that's true for everybody. I've a close set of friends back home, all guys, we're all in our 50s. There's one of us that life just seems to be on a consistent trajectory like that. His career, his family life. He is just the most positive, affirming, lovely guy that I know. The rest of us, we've all had our ups and downs. And in the 50s, in our 50s in particular, you know, there's a sense in which the midlife crisis is a real thing. I was speaking, we have a scholar in residence back at Coromila who's from South Korea, a theologian from South Korea, and we were talking about the different cultures, and he was saying, such is the pressure of life. I said to him, when do kids start school? At what time of the day do they start school in South Korea? And he said, 8, 7, 8. And what time do they finish? He said, whenever they're done. They could work right the way through to midnight and go to bed and get up and start at 7. The pressure to perform in South Korea, he said, is ferocious. And then the pressure to succeed and get a good job and succeed is huge. And he said, it's really, really hard to get young people to work in NGOs, in the NGO sector in South Korea, because the need for reputation, salary, advancement is such that people out of college are not prepared to work for less than they think they deserve. But he said the downside of it is that midlife crisis, there is a huge crisis in South Korea, he said, when people turn 40. That's when they have midlife crisis, really? And they realize all this energy they're putting into succeeding and putting into their career, and they get what they want, and then they realize, oh. And so this crisis, this emotional, spiritual, psychological crisis is getting younger and younger and younger because of the pressures. So yes, and stories are ways in which we kind of process our way, either for good or ill, through these things. And so I'm interested, something a little bit different with the story today. I think there's a way in which we can read the story which makes it personal to each of us, but there's a way of making the story, reading it, so that we can also think about the culture we're in and the world we're in. And we'll probably flip back and forth on these things as we go through. I have really appreciated in these conversations, there is, though it may not seem like it, there is diversity in this room, and I've appreciated some conversations with people outside of the room that have alerted me to the measure of the diversity in the room, and I'm really pleased that we've stayed in the room together. And I hope that we can continue to do that, and we can, as we make our comments and have our conversation, that we be aware of, you know, of who's around us, and that there are different stories being processed around us, and different meanings about the world being made around us, and we can help one another or hinder one another in that, in the way we hold this space. So I want us to think, I'm just going to do a reading. We'll stop this time as we go through on this story of the burning bush. First of all, for those of you who are familiar with the story, what details are you familiar? And again, to the preachers in the room, no sermons. I just want lines of things that happen in the story. No interpretation, just detail of the story. For those of you who are familiar with it, we'll read it in a moment. Can you remember details?
Take the shoes off your feet.
Take the shoes off your feet. Why? Because you're standing on holy ground. We're going to have to think about that. What makes the ground holy? The bush was burning, but it was not consumed. Yep.
He's walking along and then turned. How does the phrase go? Turned aside. I must turn and see this thing. There's a moment of some kind of recognition or curiosity.
Yeah. I must turn and see this thing. Why the bush is not consumed?
Fire. God's going to speak through fire.
Fire.
Yeah. This place knows all about fire and the capacity of fire to consume, the capacity of fire also to make new life. Yeah, and create space for new life. Yeah. Let's start reading. Actually, no. Before we start reading, I want you to think, just as a kind of a primer for conversation, just for a moment, I want you to think of the loneliest song lyric or line of poetry or scene from a movie, the loneliest or most disappointed lyric or image or scene or lines of poetry. Okay? This is just a quick primer, 1 minute, and talk to your partner if you want. Sit in the silence of your own head if you want, and I'll time you, and then we come back. The loneliest song lyric. Go.
Yes, I can. I love folk music.
Scene from a movie, whatever it might be, just came straight to you. Okay, very definite here. What? Give me a line or an image or a...
It was the movie Shawshank Redemption. Red just gets out of prison, and he's riding the bus, and he's hanging on for dear life.
Oh. I miss my friend. That's what he says. I miss my friend. Gorgeous, yeah.
Simon and Garfunkel's A Winter's Day. Deep and Dark.
Well, Deep and Dark. Lovely alliteration. Gorgeous.
I don't know if I have it exactly right. But
there'll be plenty of people in here who will know.
So, what great beast is time come round again slouches.
You repeat that?
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Say in your playground voice, as Sharon tells us.
What great beast is time come round again slouches toward Bethlehem to be born?
Gorgeous.
Joan Baez, did Judas Iscariot have God on his side?
Maybe that's when we do that story tomorrow.
One is the loneliest number. But the kicker is where it's one is the loneliest number except for the number two.
Yes.
Going home, but I can't remember the name of the who composed it. It's an old song, Going Home. I'm just going home.
I'm just going home. Is that kind of like personal for the moment? You're looking forward to going home for a
well,
moment?
Well, I'm
going to
have it played at my funeral.
Anybody in the balcony?
How about Tom Hanks yelling at Wilson?
I think that's a popular one. Just about anybody who knows me even remotely well knows that I'm a Bruce Springsteen fan. My wife claims that I gave my life to Bruce before I gave it to Jesus. And we've an argument with somebody here earlier on that, you know, I believe that Bruce Springsteen is the fourth person of the Trinity. And I'm more likely, I have a particular friend who, you know, when we've got these difficult issues to process or whatever, we're far more likely to message one another Springsteen lyrics than we are Bible verses. But he has a song about his early career when he was trying to make it and everything fell apart. And I think it is the loneliest. When the promise was broken, I was far away from home, sleeping in the back seat of a borrowed car. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the most poetic, the most magnificent, desolate song lyric there is. So all of your choices are wrong. This one's the right one. So carry that thinking into this reading. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he'd gone over to look, God called out to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. there's an old tradition about the life of Moses that says he spent 40 years growing in privilege in Egypt, 40 years being a nobody in Midian in the wilderness, and those 80 years together to be 40 years leading the people to the land of promise. 40 years of privilege, 40 years in the wilderness, 40 years of leadership. And that both of these first two parts of his life were necessary to the third. This is the wilderness years. He's actually on the run for murder. Mm-hmm. And he has found his way, but everything when you read the book of Exodus, is certainly these first four or five chapters are the most extraordinary story, and brilliance in the way it's written. You move from this, this teeming mass of people, and everybody is nameless except the Pharaoh, who is the tyrant. Everybody's nameless. And then you're introduced to two women, midwives, who defy the Pharaoh, and those two women are given a name. And then you get an edict of death from the Pharaoh, of killing the firstborn children. And then you get an extraordinary nameless woman who gives birth to a baby boy and hides the boy. And then an amazing line of scripture which says, when she could no longer hide her son. Now think about the pain behind that line. When she could no longer hide her son, she puts him in the reed basket and sets him away on the river. And then the baby is pulled from the water by the Pharaoh's daughter. It's only much later that we get the name of the mother in the story. We get it some chapters later. And we should pause, actually, and remember Jochebed is her name, Moses' mother. And let that name sit in the middle for a moment, like an incredible hero in the Bible story. Giving birth as a slave, hiding her son from the spies who were looking for the babies. How did she stifle his cries? How did she work as a slave and feed her child at the same time? What went through her heart and her head to that moment when the neighbors were getting nervous? Like, if this baby cries tonight, are we going to get raided? It's extraordinary when she can no longer hide her son and she is then separated from her child. Extraordinary woman. Moses is raised then in the palace with the Pharaoh. And then it talks about how he goes out of the palace. I think there's something of an identity crisis for him. He knows he's not one of the people inside the palace, the privilege of the palace. And he goes out to try and be with the people that he senses are his people, and yet they only see him as an Egyptian. And so he belongs nowhere. And he responds to some routine violence being executed on some of the people he thinks he belongs to. He responds violently to violence being done. He murders somebody and finds he has to run. And he runs away from the village because of what had happened. Then we get that first verse. Where's the loneliness? Where's the disappointment and the sadness? How does the writer of the story convey for us something of the lostness of Moses in that first sentence?
Far side of wilderness.
He's on the far side of wilderness. It's not even the near side of wilderness. It's the far side of wilderness. Anything else?
Well, he's tending the flock.
For somebody else.
He's tending the flock. It's not even his. It's somebody else's flock. Here's the guy who was brought up in the privilege of the palace, and he's tending a flock of somebody else. And he comes to Horeb, And I wonder, does he even know it's the mountain of God? I suspect not. I suspect this is just where he does his work. This is just the stuff of every day. But there is that little touch of promise in that opening verse of this, of his lostness, that in the routine of the day he comes to the mountain of Horeb. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. And when the Lord saw that he'd gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush. What do you notice about the unfolding of the story in those couple of paragraphs? Anything strike you as unusual? A close reading of it.
Never seen a fire in a bush that didn't burn the bush.
Yep.
I mean, that's unusual.
Yeah. Talk about that in a moment.
Yeah.
Somebody over, I see a hand over in the corner.
It's interesting that he went towards the unusual sight
rather than. And what do you think? What do you think brought that reaction from him?
I have no idea. It's one of those scenarios in my mind where I'm like, it's like a horror movie, right?
There's not going to be a good ending. This is the one where the bear jumps out of the bush. Yeah. This is a horror movie and something unusual is going to happen. Yeah.
Maybe he really didn't know it was fire. It's a strange sight.
But he is interested. Why does the bush not burn up? We'll come back to that later. Anything else?
God makes the first move here, and then it's Moses that responds, and then God responds.
Uh-huh. We'll come back to that in a minute.
So what I do a visual thing. The Lord saw that he had gone over to look, so the Lord's got a perspective of him as bigger, and then the Lord brings him something to the bush. God brings him something to the bush.
The order is really, really interesting.
I was just thinking, I'm struck by how he approached with a question.
Not
an answer, he's inquisitive.
I think this issue of curiosity and inquisitiveness is really interesting in the story, particularly in the context of a man for whom life has dealt him a bit of a cruel blow, and life seems arrayed against him, and he seems to be overwhelmed by life, and yet he preserved this. Here I find just lovely. I will go over and see this strange sight. It is the capacity to keep open a sense of curiosity in the face of the challenges that the world places before us. And it is this. God responds when God sees that Moses has left the path.
Yeah.
Once he steps off the path of the regular routine of tending these sheep, something shiny catches his eye and he steps off the path. And then God speaks. God doesn't call him off the path. Any other responses or any other ways in which that strikes you? Yes?
It sounds like he had nothing to lose. If you're at the bottom, why not go look? What are you going to lose?
I think you might be right. There's nothing left to... He's nothing left to lose. He's at the bottom here. Yet I don't sense desperation for something new, but there is something life-giving about curiosity in him. Sorry, I saw a hand. Yes.
Well, just notice that he's with God within the bush, not up in the clouds somewhere. You know, I hadn't paid attention to that before.
God calls to him from within the bush. We're going to come to that in a moment. So here's a couple of questions for us to reflect on. What is burning in us that is consuming us? And what is burning in us that is sustaining us? There are two questions that serve well for us as individuals in our own walk of faith, whether it's wilderness walk or whether it's something in the context of the palace. What is burning within us that is consuming us? And what is burning in us that is sustaining us? It also are two questions in this story that can function for us on a national level or a community level, whatever way we think. What is it within this community? What is it within this nation? What is burning within us that is consuming us as a people? What is burning within us that is sustaining us as people? You see, in any work, any justice work, any peace and reconciliation work, we tend to be the people that fall into this. We burn with passion for justice to the extent that it ultimately burns us up and consumes us. Mm-hmm. Our passion consumes us. What is it? How do we work for justice? How do we work for unity and peace in a way that is sustaining, not just for us as individuals, but for us as people? In part, the burning desire to win or to dominate or to be on the top is consuming. And whilst it may not consume me to win, I need to consume fuel to get there. And often, particularly at a political level, often the fuel I burn in getting there are other people. Other people pay the price for me winning. Because the pursuit of power or privilege, the pursuit of victory, needs something to consume to get there, to power us there. The question really in this, the question that intrigues Moses at the tail end of his life experience, in this desperation of life experience, is he is intrigued by the possibility that there is something that can burn within you that can be life-giving when all his experience to this point has been that the thing that burns, whether it was a burning desire to be with his people, but constantly feeling rejection, or to be with Pharaoh and his family and to find rejection. And it results in violence, and this violence consumes him from the inside out. But here he finds something in the wilderness that burns from the inside, but doesn't consume. That's what he's desperate for. Something that will burn within him but not consume. Any wisdom to throw into the mix here? Yes?
I believe that we are all called.
All?
Everyone.
I didn't hear the end.
Called. Everyone is called.
Everyone is called.
Okay. And of those that are called, some hear, some don't. And those that hear, some heed, do it, some don't. But we are all called. Everybody's called.
Anything else about these two questions? Maybe you feel one of these questions in you. Maybe you have learned something on the journey from one of these questions to the other. maybe you're reflecting on the state of play in this country at the moment. I know these are questions that we're having to carry back home.
I think that for me, those are the same thing. I think the fire that burns me, things that make me feel deeply, have a strong emotional reaction within me, working towards understanding that reaction is also what sustains me. So like if I see injustice in the world, like trying to heal that injustice is what sustains me. I've come to understand those two the same. Mm-hmm. Or at least they have a relationship with each other.
Joe, I think the doing of justice can be a sustaining thing, but we can pursue the doing of justice in a way that consumes us, consumes our relationships,
yeah,
consumes other people around us. And the question then is whether the doing of this at the cost of this has been worth it. That's the balance, really. That's a hard thing to strike. But there's no doubt, I certainly think that if I'm pursuing this work at the cost of everybody else in my life, then there is at least a question to be asked of this balance. How that doesn't release me from the need to, from the call to do justice. But is there a way of doing it that is healthy? What are the practices I carry with me in my life that enable me to keep the right balance between, you know, for instance, we can pursue justice here at the cost of every relationship in the room. There's no straightforward answer to whether that's the right thing or not, but we need to ask the question.
So did Jeremiah practice healthy boundaries and good self-care? Yeah. He's a weeping prophet, and his heart was open enough to get broken all the time, every day. And that sa'ak, that, you know, the Hebrew, the righteous cry for justice, that was killing him, you know. And yet it also fueled his work, so what do you make of that?
And he ends up being carted away off to the place where he steadfastly refused ever to go. And the end of his life is of the weeping prophet being carried away and crying to the place he never wants to go. That's why I phrased the question carefully. What wisdom in the room? What wisdom is here in the room for this task of justice work? Because I'm not offering answers here, but I am interested in the practices that sustain us for this constant draining work, which has to be done. Yes?
So on your last slide particularly, I was reflecting on two fires that I, two different conversations around a fire that I had. One was when a warehouse burned in the town that I lived in, and everybody gathered, you know, we're so curious about that. Everybody gathered around and watched it burn and talked about what a loss it was. And so it was a community of loss. And the other is the many campfires that I've been around sitting with people, and for some reason a campfire draws your soul out. It draws people into talking about community and what their lives really mean. And so that
I come back to something we talked about earlier, and that is the distinction between, when we were talking about the story of the Good Samaritan, the distinction to be made between intent and impact. It applies to the loving thing to do. And we all know examples in which somebody does terrible things, that is experienced, that are experienced by individuals as terrible words spoken or terrible actions, but they excuse themselves by saying, but my, I only intended to demonstrate love. The word of God tells me to tell you, you are wrong in this. That is the loving thing to do, and it's experienced as a denial of the individual. We need to carry with it the intent, the impact as well. And as in the story of the Good Samaritan, it is the recipient of my action that gets to tell me whether I acted as a neighbor or not. In the gospel, I release the power. I let go of the power that I imagine I have to be a neighbor. I release that power to the recipient of my love, who experiences the impact of my actions. The same can be true in the work of justice. I might claim to be working for justice and leave devastation all around me. We need to give a good account both of our intent and of our impact. And sometimes even our good actions are undermined because the impact is experienced as something other than justice or other than love.
That makes me think about what they talk a lot about at the Teze community in France, or Brother Alois, who is the leader of the community at the moment, talks a lot about what is the most important thing in any given moment. And I would say, and he would say, I think it's almost always the relationship between the people in the room. And I've recently had a big argument with one of my brothers, not this one up here, but because he often has this burning desire to be right and to basically campaign for logical thought, logical reasoning, facts, and all of that. So if I say anything that doesn't enter that way of thinking, he'll call me out on it, and it can be very assertive. And we've had conversations about this, and I just tried to get him to see, this campaign that you have is potentially destroying the relationship that we have as brother and sister. And what in this moment is actually fundamentally important to you? Is it more important? Well, it goes back to the, is it more important to be right? Or is it more important to keep that loving and compassionate dialogue alive?
Perfect. I love the way God calls Moses here. The Lord saw that he'd gone over to look. God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. In the Hebrew, there's an insistence. There's an urgency about the call of God here. It's almost as if God needs Moses. And then Moses, almost this gentle, here I am. What can I do for you? What is it you need? There's a Moses in his curiosity is not locked into this path, of this downward path, despite the isolation and the loneliness. There is still that curiosity that can pull him aside to notice something off the beaten path. Then there is the response of God to his curiosity, and then Moses responds to God. And there's a beautiful mutuality here in their relationship, almost as if they need each other. God needs Moses, and needs Moses' gentle response. There's almost a reassuring presence about Moses' response to God. Here I am. There's a big task ahead to free these people from slavery, and these two need each other to make this happen. Because even God's rescue is going to be done in an incarnational form. It's going to be done by flesh and blood. The change that's got to happen here requires flesh and blood to get involved in the task of working freedom. God isn't just going to wave a wand and make this happen. And so the urgency of the task is God's is demonstrated in God's call to Moses, and God, and Moses his response out of that curiosity is something that is reassuring to God that these things are going to happen. And then we hit, "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place you are standing is holy ground." Why is Moses taking off his shoes here?
That's what you
did. He was told to.
That's what you
did. He was told to, but why?
God calls him personally. God knows Moses, but it appears as though Moses really doesn't know what's going on here. Who is this God?
I think that's true, because God has to introduce himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But isn't he also on the mountain of the Lord, and he really didn't realize he was. So now God's informing him, hey, by the way, this is holy ground.
This is holy ground. What makes the ground holy?
The presence of God.
Okay. Any other options? This is a story. There's no right answers. We can find different doors into understanding here. What other possibilities? Is there another possibility as to why this ground might be holy?
God has incarnated himself in this spot.
Mm-hmm.
That alone should make holy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a variation on this. God is here. God is in this place. That makes it holy.
In which case, all ground is holy.
Yes. Is somebody up top here?
I was going to say something about that, Clint. Like, I hear in that the earth is sacred because God created it. And the separation from us, even moving your feet, gets you that much closer to
intimate contact.
I was just going to say the same phrase. This don't even let the sole of your shoe interfere in this intimate connection here. I wonder if part of the holiness, the part of the thing that makes this ground holy, part of the thing that warms the ground here is not the sun, is not just the fire of God in the bush. It's the fact that this is also, this earth is the place, this point on the earth is the place where human beings and God's person have come together. There's a union happening here. There is a meeting happening here.
It's like respecting the moment and not just the place, right?
That's what I was saying. It's not about the space, this spot of ground, but the moment. We're in a holy moment, not just this little patch of ground here. Yeah.
This is where encounter is happening.
Do not come any closer, though. Isn't that interesting? Do not come any closer.
Because this could consume you. Could consume you.
Wonder where the fire went.
And this idea, you know, God isn't to be played with. And I think sometimes in the practice of our faith, we play with God. We play with the presence of God. And, you know, and certainly in our politics, we play with God. God, you don't toy with God. You don't adopt God into your own special project. There's a pattern repeated throughout the Bible, throughout the Hebrew Bible in particular, that is always the people of God are always on their way out of slavery towards freedom, and always on their way back into slavery again. Always. That's the pattern. They get out of Egypt, and they're brought out into the wilderness, and then they build a city, and the first thing they do is they establish all the systems and structures. You find out when they get the city, and they build the temple for the presence of God, who builds the temple?
Slaves
build the temple. So this journey out of slavery has led them back to slavery again, into the institution of slavery. And then God has to do something again to get them out of that, brings them on to, into exile. And then they come back in, and then there's another argument about what holiness is. And so you get these rules about, you know, getting rid of foreign women out of the country. And you get always this journey out of slavery into freedom, but back into slavery again, circling round and round and round again. God is constantly calling them out, and they are constantly then starting to toy with God, which gets them back into some kind of slavery and some kind of mistreatment of one another. And I think God is both saying, come close, but not so close. Don't toy with me in these things. Don't think that you can, whether in your wokeness or your conservative ideas, don't imagine that either wing owns God. Because God is both near and far. Come near, but stay away. Don't toy. And Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God.
Does he actually pick up his sandals though? It doesn't explicitly say that he takes them off.
No.
So we don't
have to know. This is actually a really interesting, as a trope, it reoccurs frequently throughout the Bible, this idea of taking off your shoes. There's a really, really interesting, we maybe finish this part, this session, with this story. Later on, when they're camped around Sinai and God's giving them the law, God invites Moses and some of the leaders of the people up to have a meal with God up on the top of the mountain. So Moses chooses these leaders, and they all go up. The people kind of appoint them, bless them, and away they climb up Sinai to the presence of God. And it says they, despite what it says elsewhere in the text, it says they looked and saw God. And they had a meal with God. And then they come back down. And then they have to give a report to the people at the bottom of the mountain about what they had seen. So some of you will know the story. I want you to keep shtum just for a minute, or keep quiet just for a minute. Imagine a delegation from your congregation received an invitation to go and meet God. So you hire a bus, and we select from among the room here a bunch of people who are going to meet God. And they jump on the bus and they go somewhere. They walk, you know, wherever God is, they walk to this place and they meet with God. And then they phone ahead to say, we've met with God, gather the rest of the village in the VC, because we're going to give you a report about what we saw. And so we're all waiting next door on our seats for our delegation to come back. And in they walk, and they stand in front of us. What's the first question you would want to ask? There's no right answer. What questions would you want to ask of the people who've gone to meet God?
What did God say?
Yeah. What did he say here? How was the conversation like? Is he interested in the sports? What did he look like? Yeah.
What was for dinner?
What did God make? Lovely question. Yeah. I want to know, was Bruce Springsteen there? Any other questions?
What was in music?
What did he look like? What does God look like? What did God say? What was prepared for dinner? In the Bible story, when they come back to give a report, can anybody remember what answer they gave? In the book, the answer they gave is, and this is it, he was standing on a pavement made of lapis lazuli. What? Well, what did he look like? What did God look like?
Yeah.
You should have seen the path he was standing on. It was made of lapis lazuli. What did you have for dinner? It was blue like the sky. And it, you know, some people say they couldn't look on God, so they could only look on what God was standing. But the text says they looked God in the eye. They saw God. And all they report back is he was standing on a pavement made of lapis lazuli. So what does that mean? And the interesting thing about it, sorry, I'm a geek when it comes to these stories. The interesting thing in the story is they were standing on a pavement made of lapis lazuli. The word pavement in Hebrew is exactly the same word that is used in Exodus chapter 5 when the Pharaoh doubled down on the work that the slaves had to do and said, they must make the exact same number of bricks, but this time don't give them any straw. They have to gather their own straw. It's exactly the same word in both places. And Jewish commentators on this are obviously the best. We lose the point in all the, you know, trying to explain what they do. And in Jewish scholars make a connection between the slavery and the making of bricks in Egypt and those same bricks and the pavement that God was standing on. And what they reckon, there is obviously that transformation of the bricks of their toil and slavery into this beautiful pavement that God stands on. But the other thing, I think, that is at least worth considering is the solidarity of God with the suffering of God's people. That even when Pharaoh was doubling down on the toil and increasing the oppression and the injustice, the text is telling us, even though it didn't look like it, the text is telling us God was there all the time. Even in the toil of their injustice and the oppression they were experiencing. And whilst they were forced to imagine in the midst of it, in the midst of this disappointment, in the midst of this loss and lostness, that God was absent and this was wilderness, God is saying, I was with those bricks all the time. I was there all the time. And that the presence of God, the presence of God burns around us. We sometimes lack the curiosity to turn to the side, or sometimes we are so locked into the route we want this to go that we fail to see, and they are simply bricks, and we're scrabbling around hunting for the straw to make the bricks. And the task becomes everything, and we fail to see what God is doing in the midst of this challenging life and this challenging world. God identifies intimately in suffering. You wouldn't think that to look at much of our faith practice, where we prefer, we look upon the comforts and the privilege we have as the benefits that God has brought into our lives. In the book of Hebrews, it says that Jesus was crucified outside the camp, outside the city walls. And then it says, therefore, let us go out to him where he is. We imagine we have God with us inside the security of our walls. And then we bring Jesus out with us. The text tells us consistently from start to finish, God is already with those who are suffering. And if we want to get with God, we need to lift our sight and our eyes and go to where God already is. To be with those who are on the margins of our society, to be with those who are pushed to the side or ignored. God is not with us in our privilege. God is with those who are suffering, and our work of justice making is to go and be there and stand with those and advocate with those who are on those margins. To use whatever, to leverage whatever privilege we do have to bring the plight of those to sight. Any other comments or reactions?
I was just thinking about that from what you said. Moses didn't go back to slavery with the other people. He went shepherding his father-in-law's flock, which is a different status. So he didn't go down to the depths. He went to middle class, kind of, in a sense. I mean, I think that's kind of interesting. I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, I mean, there are people better qualified in this room to talk about, in chapter 2, Moses rescues some women who were being threatened by some men at a well. We're not told what Moses did, but we know what he's capable of, because we've seen that elsewhere in the story. But whatever he does, the women don't feel threatened by him, but he deals with these threatening men. And he ends up marrying into Jethro's family. He calls the first child born of that relationship, he calls the son Gershom, which means I'm a foreigner. Now, that's a really odd name to give your firstborn child. And I think it gives us some insight into the mental state. Whatever about his circumstances, the mental state of Moses, I think the names of his children give us some insight to the struggles that were going on in his heart and his spirit and his head. And what a burden to place on the shoulders of your child, to carry your own sense of dislocation. And of course we do that all the time. The sins of the fathers are visited upon the children, and again, that happens. The trauma of parents is passed on, and is passed on in our DNA to succeeding generations. And it's clear here, even in the naming of the children. It is the capacity for Moses to keep alive some degree of curiosity, even in wilderness. And I'm interested in the practices that might help us, even in wilderness years, whether they are the wilderness you feel that the current cultural state of the country is wilderness, or the current state of the denomination or your congregation is wilderness. How do we sustain, what practices do sustain us for this ongoing battle that will constantly pull us to the side? The mere fact that you have come to Holden is a turning aside off the path. The mere fact that many of us sit in rooms in which people like me and others put forward ideas that are challenging, uncomfortable, means that at least whatever it is that has drawn you here, there is the possibility of something sustaining, because there's a curiosity, there's a turning aside, there's a curiosity, and as I keep saying, there's a willingness to stay in the room in the presence of uncomfortable ideas and uncomfortable thoughts. That indicates that there is capacity here for the long haul in the work of justice. It's when we emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually we lose that capacity to turn aside, that we're going to need friends around us who can alert us to that state. I'm thinking we need to wrap up because there's someone else in here in a few minutes, and some of you need sustenance or need escape. Tomorrow on the schedule is the story of Boaz and Ruth and the politics of compassion. But we could change it up a little and look at a gospel story which looks at some of the practice of Jesus in the face of conflict. If you're happy enough to leave it up to me to make a choice, but I'd be interested if there's energy to hear it talk about the politics of compassion from the story of Ruth and Boaz, I'd be happy to see that. The other option is the story of the story we call it generally, it's not really a Sunday school story, the woman caught in adultery and the practice of Jesus' response to what he finds in that conflict situation. So Ruth and Boaz,
don't care.
Okay. Anybody wanting to hear the story of Jesus? The woman
cool.
Okay, I'll make a choice.
Over to you.
You'll be surprised. Thank you again.
Thank you.